This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
After Eric Richens died, Corey wrote a children's book, Are You With Me? The title. About a father who dies and becomes a firefly, watching over his children from above. A story about grief and healing and love that transcends death. She went on morning shows to promote it. She sat across from hosts, talked about loss, about resilience, about helping her children through the hardest time of their lives. Writing the book, what an exercise it was in working through her grief. She performed The Grieving Widow on national television, selling a book about the death she allegedly caused. A book that she actually didn't write, but she performed that she did. And here's what gets me about the whole damn thing. She put herself at the center, not Eric, not the children, her. The devoted mother helping a family heal. The author with something meaningful to say about loss. The woman who found a way to turn tragedy into inspiration. That takes a specific kind of mind. Not just the ability to kill someone, but the need to be seen as the hero of the story afterward. The inability to stay in the shadows. The compulsion to step into the spotlight and collect sympathy for the crime you committed. This is part four of The Perfect Wife, and this one is about the narcissist's fatal flaw. The need to control the narrative, to author reality, to make everyone else a character in your story. And I want to get your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and Substack as we work through this. The links are in the description. Nancy Crampton Brophy wrote an essay in 2011 called How to Murder Your Husband. That's not a joke. That's not me editorializing. That's the actual title of an essay she published under her real name on a writer's forum. She discussed methods. Hitman, too risky. They might talk. Poison, hard to obtain in lethal quantities. Gun, loud and messy, but effective. She weighed pros and cons like she was planning a vacation or comparing cell phone plans. And then she wrote this. If the murder is supposed to set me free, I certainly don't want to spend any time in jail. 7 years later, she shot her husband Daniel twice in the chest. The essay was excluded from her trial. Too old, the judge ruled, written too long before the crime to be directly relevant. But everything about Nancy Crampton Brophy tells the same story. The story of someone who believes they're the author of reality. Someone who thinks they can write the narrative to make everyone else play their assigned parts. That's a narcissist delusion. And it's what caught her. Daniel Brophy was a culinary instructor at the Oregon Culinary Institute in Portland. A chef. His students loved him. He was the kind of person who showed up early, did his work well, didn't need anyone to notice or applaud. Quiet competence, steady presence. Nancy was not that. She was a self-published romance novelist with modest sales and big dreams. Her books weren't setting the world on fire. The finances were strained, and there were life insurance policies on Daniel worth about $1.4 million. And in the months before Daniel's death, Nancy bought a Glock 17 handgun. She bought a ghost gun kit, parts that allow you to assemble an untraceable firearm. When investigators later asked about those purchases, she had an answer ready. Research! For a book. Writers do this all the time. June 2nd, 2018, Daniel arrives at the Oregon Culinary Institute around 7:15 a.m. early, like always. He's preparing for his morning class. Students won't arrive until 7:30. He's shot twice in the chest. No witnesses, no security footage inside the building. The killer takes the gun and leaves. But here's what Nancy didn't account for. Cameras exist. beyond the walls she was watching. Surveillance footage from near the school captured a minivan matching Nancy's vehicle arriving that morning and leaving shortly after. The timing aligned perfectly with Daniel's death. Nancy's alibi was simple. She was home writing. No witnesses, just her word. And for a while, she must have believed that would be enough, because the narcissist is always the smartest person in the room, in their own mind. They've imagined this scenario 100 times. They know exactly how to play the grieving widow. They've rehearsed the performance. They can't imagine anyone seeing through it, because truly imagining that would require believing that other people are real, that other people are paying attention, that other people might be as smart as you or have emotions or feelings. The narcissist, by definition, can't believe that. So Nancy bought a ghost gun parts, with methods that could be traced. She drove her own minivan to the crime scene. She wrote an essay about murdering her husband and published it under her real name. She couldn't help it. She needed to be seen. She needed someone, even if just her writer friends on the forum, to appreciate how clever she was, how she could think through these dark scenarios, how her mind worked. That need is what catches them every damn time. If you've ever dealt with a narcissist, and I don't mean that word casually, I mean someone who genuinely can't conceive of other people as real, you know the specific blindness I'm describing. They leave evidence everywhere, because staying invisible requires imagining that someone else might be watching. It requires thinking about the world from another person's perspective. And that's the one thing they can't do. Nancy left the ghost gun parts on a credit card statement. She left her minivan on camera near the crime scene. She left an essay online explaining exactly how she'd thought about killing her husband. She thought she was writing a story. She forgot that other people were reading. Daniel Brophy deserved better than to be a plot point. He was a real person. He had students who admired him. He had a career he'd built over years. He walked into work early that morning because that's who he was. Someone who showed up, did the work, didn't ask for credit. And his wife looked at him and saw an obstacle. A character who'd outlived his usefulness in the story she was writing. A problem to be resolved so she could get to the ending she wanted. $1.4 million in life insurance. That's what Daniel was worth to Nancy. That's a number that made him worth killing. The trial happened in 2022. Nancy took the stand. She was composed, articulate, confident. She had explanations for everything. The gun purchases, research, the ghost gun kit, research, the minivan near the school. All coincidence. But the story didn't hold together. Too many coincidences. Too many purchases. Too perfect a timing. The jury convicted her of second-degree murder, life in prison, with the possibility of parole after 25 years. She still says she's innocent. Of course she does. Admitting guilt will require admitting she's not special, that her plan wasn't clever, that she's not a protagonist of this story. She's the villain. The narcissist can't accept that. It breaks everything they believe about themselves. I keep thinking about that essay, How to Murder Your Husband. She wrote it down. She put her name on it. She published it on the internet for anyone to find. Some part of her wanted people to see how clever she was, how she could think through these scenarios, weigh the options, understand the risks. She wanted credit for her dark imagination, and she got it, just not the way she expected. Corey Richens wrote a children's book about Eric's death. She went on television to promote it. She positioned herself at the center of the tragedy she allegedly caused. Both women needed to be seen, needed to control how people understood them, needed to be the author of the narrative, even when the narrative was about a murder they committed. And that need is what catches them. The narcissist can't stay invisible. They can't resist the spotlight. They can't let someone else tell the story. So they step forward. They write the book. They do the interview. They put their face on camera and their words on record. And eventually someone starts reading. Someone who
sees the story differently than they do. Someone who notices that the grieving widow knew a little too much, planned a little too carefully, appeared a little too quickly to control the narrative. Nancy Crampton Brophy thought she was writing a romance novel where she was the sympathetic heroine, finally free of a difficult husband. The jury read it as a crime story where she was the killer. Same events, different interpretation. The narcissist forgets that readers get to decide what the story means. Daniel Brophy walked into work that morning. He unlocked the doors. He started prepping for class. He had no idea his wife was outside, waiting. He was real. His life mattered, and Nancy treated him like a character she could delete whenever it suited her plot. That's the narcissist delusion. Believing you're the author of reality, believing everyone else is fiction. Reality doesn't work that way, and eventually the story you wrote gets read by people who see it for what it actually is. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. We'll continue our conversation there. Right now, Substack, no paywall. Come join us on that community. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link in the description. Go check it out. And wherever you're getting podcasts, if you've not already subscribed to our podcast platform, the audio version of our program, please do so wherever you get podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart. Grab your device right now. Look us up, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Hit subscribe, and you'll get us wherever you go. We do greatly appreciate that. All right, we'll continue the conversation in the comments section. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Every relationship with someone who operates in this sort of way eventually reaches a breaking point. Sometimes the partner walks away. Sometimes they get discarded first. And sometimes, in the most extreme cases, the person holding all of the control decides they're not willing to let it end on anyone's terms but their own. Eric Richens, according to prosecutors, was quietly consulting with divorce attorneys and estate planning lawyers before he died. He was starting to find his way out. This part is about what happens at the end. And for anyone in it right now, how to get out in one piece. With me is Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. Siobhan, what typically triggers the end phase in these sort of relationships? Is the targeted partner finally leaving? Is that what does it? Or does the person with these patterns often engineer the collapse themselves?
Well, very often the targeted partner, the light bulbs start coming on. And It may be that there's irrefutable evidence about, in this case, the financial things that were going on. I mean, that just became so flagrant. And often they start to set boundaries. They start to set limits. Mm-hmm. And that pushes the predatory partner often into a rage because they're losing control. Mm-hmm. And so things may escalate. And that's one of the dangerous times, because you never know when that partner's enraged, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, that's when violence starts, or sometimes murder starts, sometimes murder-suicide. But that's when things can get really dicey. And I think it can come out of the blue. It may be something that you never saw coming. Mm-hmm. But that's the time you find a good therapist or person with a domestic violence counseling background, and you try to go through what are the stages I need to prep in order to get out of here safely and protect the kids and figure out legally what my options are. So it's usually a gradual phase, you know, just like people don't get married in one day, there's a process. They don't get divorced in one day, there's a process. And you have to often have someone coaching you for how do I do this safely and look at the finances, look at the custody. I mean, it's really complicated.
I got a quick question about that, because oftentimes with characters like this, the smallest, what's your phrase all the time, Robin? Something in the force, the tremor in the force? Is that
a tremor in the force or a tremor wobble?
A wobble in the force, where there's just the slightest. When you decide, I'm going to put up a boundary, I'm not just going to let you do anything you want and just agree with everything you say because I'm fearful of what your reaction is going to be if anybody slightly suggests anything different. If you put up a small boundary, just the small, like, you know what? No, I'm not. That's not going to work out for me. I'm not going to be able to. We're not going to do this, or I'm not going to participate in whatever this may be. Just the smallest thing. Not shouldn't be into a healthy relationship. The partner would be like, oh, okay, cool. Well, you have a great night. I'm going to go do this. But in situations like this, those small little things can feel, I guess, like the end to the partner who is the controlling, monstrous one. And they react as if you just said, here's divorce papers. When you just said, you know what? I'm going to watch reruns of Cheers tonight rather than going out. They will treat it as an atomic bomb going off. So it's very hard, which also then keeps you trapped in those situations because you can't just go to a healthy place and slowly start instilling small boundaries to keep a healthy relationship or maybe elevate the relationship to a healthy place because that controlling partner won't let you put up one barrier. With that being said, it's someone who's in that sort of a situation, it's very difficult to slowly work your way out because everything is huge. And that's why sometimes it feels like you just kind of go full force, like, all right, well, it's going to be an atomic bomb no matter what. How do you navigate that sort of thing when one person's cognitive distortions are so far out there that they see the slightest demonstration of self-autonomy as the biggest threat in the world to them?
I think in cases, you know, where it's going to be potentially dangerous like that, you have to do it covertly. You know, if you start your own savings account privately so you have some funds, you talk to lawyers, you talk to domestic violence counselors, and you have to keep that secret, unfortunately. Typically in a marriage relationship, I'm not in favor of secrets. I think couples should be honest with each other. But this is a case where you have to keep it quiet and do your plan so that when, you know, I mean, you can just pack up and leave one day if you have the resources.
Yeah.
And if you don't have kids, it's much easier to do that. And, you know, yes. So there are cases where it's just like, get out, cut the tie, move out of the house. But when you've got a lot of joint assets, when you've got children, it's probably going to be something you have to do a lot of planning for in advance. And and custody is a huge problem with, as you say, you don't want the abusive partner to get custody of the kids.
Yeah.
So that takes a lot of strategy.
Yeah, I'd imagine that, you know, in these cases, as we've been discussing this, you have the imagery going through my mind is like two countries at war on the board. I mean, just think of Russia and Ukraine, right? So you have Russia coming in to usurp land, and then all of a sudden you've got the power struggle. I want that land back. And so two people in the same kind of thing. So you have the supreme narcissist control freak that if the spouse or the partner tries to take a little bit of that territory back, you know, set it at a boundary, and they completely freak, lose their mind, fight battle, and eventually will keep battling until they get their territory back. That to me is that major red flag, that last thing where, like you said, I'm all about transparency, Siobhan, too, because transparency is the great mitigator of all things, right? But at that point, you got to think of it as a spy case, as an operation. Yeah. When we were working with our counterintelligence spy operatives, we had to create secret exfiltration plans, because if the bad guys knew where they were going to go, what were they going to do? They're going to hunt them down and kill them. And Tony, what's the one case? Oh, the millionaire murders, right? What's his face? That the woman, the wife divorced the husband, and then 8 years later, he finally he's being accused of charging.
Tepe?
Yeah, Tepe, the Tepe case.
Oh, yeah,
You know, I mean, there's a great example of there's someone actually exfiltrated themselves, but they were still being hunted down because you still knew where to get them. So you got to do the secret exfiltration. I'm not, we're not saying, hey, run away and hide from everyone.
No.
But you talk to loving critics.
And I feel like a lot of times, you know, because we, if you're a healthy person, you're going to come to it from kind of a healthy mindset, and healthy people can have conversations about conflict, can have resolution to conflict, and can move on and move forward. But when you're dealing with someone who's incapable of that, how important is it to recognize and call a spade for what it is? Because if someone's listening to this and they're already at this end phase and they're like, they don't need more proof. Is it completely a fruitless battle to engage that person in any sort of reasonable conversation about fixing anything, about getting anything to change, airing those grievances? I mean, the temptation, I think, in a lot of cases, especially when things get really bad, is okay, especially if the perpetrator here, the narcissist, the borderline, whatever it is attacking and saying horrible things. It is to react, and it is to tell them off, to tell them the reality, to really lay into them. But does that ever help a damn thing? I mean, is that ever the approach anyone should take with a person like this? As good as that would feel in that moment, the damage that that can do and the danger that that can put you into is oftentimes, I guess, from my experience, from everything I've learned about this, it's never worth it. And that's why gray rocking is so important with folks like this. What's your take, Siobhan, for somebody who's listening to this right now in that position, who really is like, I want to tell them what's up.
What
would you say?
Yeah, people try to have those conversations because they want to get through to them. They want to point out their errors. They want to point out how they're wrong. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And counselors, you know, I have had people in therapy where I get one of the partners alone and say, you know, this, what you're trying to do here, I don't think you should be doing couples therapy, because it's not helpful and it's going to make things worse for you. And so what I encourage people to do, as you say, gray rocking, detach, just detach. And if you need a therapist to go talk about your anger and grief and frustration, that's where you take the message and you talk about it privately. But detach from the need to engage with the predator.
Yeah, I'm wholehearted on that one. Don't engage crazy, man. That's my main philosophy in life. Don't engage crazy. You know, those nutters will drag you down, because there's, and a lot of times, because, you know, Siobhan, and you said it really good, a lot of times what's driving us to want to engage him and confront him? Our ego and vanity and need to be right, to justify our actions to them. No, who cares?
Exactly.
You're only doing it for self-gratification. No, stop it. You don't need it. They don't need it. They don't care. Really, the words you're about to say don't matter. There's nothing you could say that's going to sink into them because they are nuts. Don't even do it.
Yeah.
1,000%. And it's hard, because that's a muscle in itself.
Because we want to get them. We want to jam it to them.
Yeah.
Nope. Let go.
It's just, there's no point. It's hard. It is hard, because that is the reaction. But trust me, and I say probably anyone who's been through this, that will not help you in any way, shape, or form. No. Resist and go and find a way to heal and detach. That's what needs to be done.
Don't talk to crazy.
There was another case we were talking about earlier. There's the Kelsey Fitzsimmons case, which woman in jail for 100 days because she couldn't blow into the breathalyzer as part of the terms of being released. She was shot in the lung. She didn't have the ability to breathe into it. But they kept saying, well, part of the release is you have to do this this breathalyzer. Well, she's not able to. It's like saying, okay, just get him to swear on the Bible. They don't have an arm. Like, use your right hand. Like, well, just use your right hand to swear on the Bible. Their arm's not there, but they can do it. Everybody has to swear on the Bible. No, they don't. They can't. It's not, doesn't exist. But this is what you need to do. And just kind of getting caught in that loop. Yeah. Get out of the loop. Get out of the loop and recognize the armless person for what they are, because they're never going to swear on that Bible with their right hand. So just accept it and move the F on. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts in the comment section and on Substack, YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. We got a great community here who's been through a lot of this stuff, too. If you're listening to this and recognizing it and finding it therapeutic and helpful, great. Be sure to weigh in. But we're not medical advice. So be sure to, of course, always consult your own medical experts on anything. All right. Siobhan's book, it is here, Nightbird. You can read all about her adventures in this world. It's a story. Definitely do check it out. Robin's brand new book, also applicable to all this. Good one for Corey. Corey, I hear you're going to be having a little time in prison for a little while. Let me recommend this to you, Corey, as you're Googling yourself, because I know you can't resist and you're watching us tell stories about you and talk about how fucking batshit crazy you are. This would be a great book. It's Not All About Me. I'm sure you'll glean a lot from it. But for those of you who aren't like her, you will. So enjoy. It's available now wherever books are sold. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.